Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 163, Pilgrimage, Psychosis, Compassion, and Mosquitoes.
We are all psychotic, is the Buddha's insight. Really? I mean, so I'm serious. What do you do? I'm not saying you're behaving like a psychotic.
I
might be more psychotic than you at behavior. I'm not accusing that. I'm saying that everyone is wired around because of the sensitivity of living beings, because of the massive suffering of life, is wired around that there is this thing inside that isn't connected to all this, that's not here. Okay? And then we can't find that. So then people create ideas, oh, well, this not here is a little piece of a big God who's not here, but who will take it out of here if I behave. Okay? Which is a psychotic God, actually. Because he's absolutely disconnected. You know, in all those theologies, the absolute otherness of God, you know, my Protestant theological colleagues will go on like that. That's just a big inflation of the psychosis, of feeling that there's the real thing here is not here. And that's really me, I'm really not here. So all this pain I have will somehow go away because I'm not really here. It's just like, which is where psychosis comes from. Wait a second. So then, the space like equipoise samadhi, of looking, because that comes from challenging the idea of being only relationally here. Fully here, that is. My real secret essence is not here. Fully here. And the looking is, because it's examining this feeling of sight, of me not being here, under the Buddha's challenge. So then I'm using the energy of the being that it thinks it isn't here to look for the being that thinks it isn't here, and then I don't find it, and then the last thing I find is a big space that isn't here. So those ideas of nirvana as a dualistic apart from the world, which is the Buddhist distortion of it, the Hindu one of the Paramatma, the Supreme Self that isn't, God as isn't here of the other mystics, which they're all going to get away from all this suffering, is all just a projection of this inner psychosis. Mm-hmm. And the only solution for it is to really realize that all of us are totally really here, and that it's all right to be really, really here, because the dominant thing about being really, really here is we don't want to hurt each other, because we don't want to be hurt by other people. And the deepest energy of it all is therefore love. Love means an energy that it wants to heal everything, to fulfill everything. You know, infinite energy means it doesn't want any lack of energy anywhere. Or automatically. It isn't like personal, you know. And that's accessible to all of us. And when you really know you're here, there is no choice. It's like Groundhog Day. There's no way of getting out of that day except by being totally there that day for everyone else. That's why it's such a brilliant film, you see. That's the Buddhist realization.
Yes.
And the Hindu one gets close to it and has all kind of aspect from the huge presence of Buddhism for 1500 years. But then when the Muslims came and burned down the universities, that ego reasserted itself and the Brahmins said, oh, Buddha, he was God, but he taught a wrong teaching. And what was the wrong teaching? He was God's ninth avatar. And he taught it to people who were not proper Brahmins. So they wouldn't do Vedic rituals and have power of the gods behind them. And then the 10th avatar Vishnu comes and kills all of them. That's a weird way they distorted their memory of Buddha. Seriously, that's what they say. Kauki, the 10th incarnation of Vishnu, comes and destroys all the bad people who don't respect the Brahmins. Do you realize that? It's demented, actually. And some student had a written question for the Dalai Lama, and they said, Your Holiness, it was on Buddhist ethics or something. They said, Your Holiness, have you ever done anything unethical? So then he's like 16, and then he says, well, he said, I guess I guess I'll share my history with mosquitoes. And then everybody's looking like this, expecting whatever. And then he says, well, you know, I want to, when I meditate sometimes, he says, mosquitoes sometimes come around. He said, and he says, when I'm not in a malaria-infested region, the first mosquito that comes, I use in my meditation, and I observe it as it drinks the blood. And I watch it, and then it gets enough, and then it flies off. And then there was a neuroscientist on stage with him, and then he said, and I notice it doesn't look very grateful. He says, I wonder if the brain has to develop to a certain point before it can show appreciation. And then he says, then the second one comes, and then it wants to drink. Oh, I see. It wants to drink, he says. And then he says, I'm a little fed up with that. So he goes like this. So he says, I blew it away. He says, and then the next one comes, he says. And I look at that, and then he looks around the huge audience, and he goes. Everybody completely cracks up, and he makes like a maniacal laugh, really. Terrible, confirming the Chinese worst fears. This is why the Dalai Lama likes to, he's so into this thing with science, you know, and he's always talking to these scientists. Although mostly, unfortunately, up to now, he's mostly been listening to them because they tend to think that they know better. They do. They admire these yogis and these Eastern sages and whatever. And of course, anybody who meets him admires him enormously because he's so sincere and so has such great integrity personally, but and good humor for that matter. As far as they got that way somehow because they're Easterners or they live in a mountain or they didn't have enough oxygen or they, whatever it is, or they meditated a lot or they didn't have email to be stressed out with, whatever the reason, it couldn't possibly be that they got that way because they understand the mind and reality and matter and everything better. And maybe that ours is we're still groping around the corner. And we think we're great because we have so much power of interfering in physical reality around us. We can destroy atoms. We can annihilate cities. We could annihilate the whole planet in about half an hour. We can completely poison anybody. We can poison every river, destroy the climate. I mean, destroy a planet that's been hanging around for millions of years. I mean, and that makes us think we're smart. So then those scientists are always telling Dalai Lama, oh yeah, we're like the medulla oblongata. You know, we're after it. Maybe that's why you're enlightened, because the medulla, something's going down there in the medulla. And the pons superiori and this and that and other. And we're out there and we're dissecting those monkeys. They do. They have like prosciutto slicers, super fine. And they put these cats and monkeys into them, and after dying the brain, and then they watch, they get upset, they get that cat upset, and then they slice their brain and see where the dye went, you know. They're going to figure it out from that. I mean, it's actually a bit stupid. In fact, it's a bit stupid. It really is stupid. It isn't just arrogant, it's also stupid. Do you know what I mean? They should ask their own mom how they can be happy, rather than cut up some cat. Seriously. You know, but always, you know, when you get a dogmatic religious hierarchy in history, one of the things that they do to impress people is sacrifice animals. They do. That sort of shows they have a big power. You know? They, like the Vedic ritual was like that, I'm sorry. But that the Vedic ritual was an animal sacrifice ritual, originally. It really was what it was. They go on Veda, those nice vegetarian Hindus that, you know, they think Vedas, they didn't get that from the Vedas. The Vedas are a bunch of high priests sacrificing some animal, offering them to Indra, and thinking that by doing that they're going to get somewhere, you know. The Taoists were like ripping apart some turtle and looking at its entrails, or burning its bone, or something like that. So they have all these funny gimmicks because they can't understand reality. But, you know, Lao Tzu, probably Confucius even, Buddha for sure,
And these people, you know, Yajnavalkyas, the Upanishadic people, they actually figured it out by going inside and looking how their brain worked from within the brain and figuring it out, and beyond the, going beyond the brain too. And you know, anyway, Dalai Lama was talking to the scientists, and they may soon begin to listen to him a little bit. And he's trying to upgrade also the ability of the learned Tibetan high lamas and people by having them learn the language of contemporary science to be able to explain their reservations and explain some new quantum steps that they can take to deal with it. You know? And the quantum people are the best allies, because the quantum people within the material scientists are the ones who have reached the place of uncertainty in their thinking that they have a hold of matter and they're going to control it with their machinery and their theories and their mathematics. And they know that that's not possible. They have reached the point where they're looking into the abyss of the inconceivability of reality, ultimately. That there's no controlling it from an egocentric, theoretical perspective. Not possible. And yet there's a way of knowing it by merging with it, by becoming it. You know, the way of knowing, the way a poet knows. Like the great Japanese poet Basho said, he said, if you want to, you know, write a poem, you want to express the pine tree, you have to become the pine tree. And then the haiku comes, then the pine tree speaks through you, you know. You know, the great Basho, if anybody knows about Basho. In the stillness of an ancient pond, an old frog jumps in, the sound of the water. You know that one? But the way people translate it is they go plop in English. The frog is at the stillness of an ancient pond, the old frog, plop. But the Japanese can say plop. They didn't say that. They said mizu no oto. They said the sound of the water. But they're too clever to translate it correctly. And so they enter, they have a eureka moment, and they go plop. I love it. I'm sorry, I can't help myself.
We know. Okay.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing series Pilgrimage, using classic field recordings from the Dosset tours of Robert Thurman and the Tibet House membership community to elucidate basic ideas and concepts of the tradition. Watch classic episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast, remastered and rendered as educational videos on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. Every view, like, comment, and subscription helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. And now back to Bob and the second half of this week's podcast.
So today we're going to, okay, let's meditate. Enough joking around. Okay, meditative mode. Cross the feet. Hands together in the lap, sitting up straight. If your eyes closed, I'll realize you didn't sleep well, and it's fine. If you leave them just a little open, that's better. Okay, so then, here we are in this wonderful, wonderful place, actually. Nina had a good sleep and she had a lot of vivid dreams, which she attributes to the power of the stream. I kept trying to ask her what her dreams were about, but she wouldn't tell me, except that they were very clear. And then later it kind of leaked out that she was straightening out some of her employees in dream conversation. So here we are in this marvelous place, and we look up from the stream, the roaring stream. And there's whoever is your favorite teacher, your utmost person, the Dalai Lama, or the Buddha, or Jesus, or Moses, or Krishna, whoever it is. And that person is up there looking and happy that you're meditating, and you can have as many as you want. The whole heavenly host in the sky above you, so that you're in the presence of such a person, such beings that you admire. That's the main point. You don't have to have a tree, or you don't have to have whatever. It's just that you remember that you are in the presence of whoever you think is the most marvelous being that you can imagine. And then beings that you can imagine. Then around you also are the regular beings that you deal with all the time. The ones you like, the ones you just know, and the ones you dislike. And then the light coming to you from the advanced beings, the high beings, the admired beings, the radiance, the blessing, reflects from you back out to all the beings around you. And this is the setting. So your motive in seeking some sort of understanding through meditating, developing your understanding through meditating, is for yourself and all those other beings simultaneously. By visualizing them, even for a splashing second, you're acknowledging your connection to them, your shared presence in the universe with them, and in a way, your condition as reflecting in their condition and vice versa. Okay, and then just enjoy being in this kind of marvelous nexus through your awareness and imagination. And your imagination really is just an unusual use of your imagination. I'm sure many of you have the notion that you can't visualize something, or it won't stay stable in your mind, or how can I possibly imagine such things, etc. This kind of notion will arise in the mind when doing this kind of practice. And part of it comes from not realizing that one is imagining one's regular environment, ordinary environment, all the time, all day long. When you see a flower, your mind is fitting your brain's image of a flower over the photons that are hitting your neurons that are reflecting off the surface of that supposed objective flower. So your imagination is actually structuring your ordinary experience, and it's busy doing that. So therefore, there's not that much left over for it. Inner visualization, unless you cultivate the ability. But we don't think we imagine it, we just think it's out there the way we see it. But that is, of course, an error, or one other of many errors. Anyway, we're in this setting, and now remember what we've learned so far in our previous intensive. So we just remind ourselves, like playing the first four notes in a scale. We remind ourselves of the preciousness of our liberty and opportunity as amazing human beings that each of us is. Liberty from all kinds of defects and disabilities and negative embodiments that we could be in. And with the opportunities of becoming conscious about the evolutionary causality web in which we are embedded, to shift it to the benefit, greater benefit of ourselves and others, and to consciously evolve in a positive direction with enormous quantum leaps of progress open to us with certain level of effort and understanding. What a precious and marvelous situation, actually. That's the first one, remember? And then second one, awareness about death. The three themes that I will definitely die. No question about it, and I'm not sure what will happen after that. But I'm not really going to indulge in being sure that what will happen will be nothing. So I better prepare. Second, I don't know when it will be. Could be any time after the end of this trip. And third, when it does, it will be my soul level of subtle heart, deepest heart, that will go on, and therefore I should invest my effort in that level of my being. We follow, that's the second one, right? Just to remember it. And third one is, how do I shape that in a positive way? And we have the three physical of saving lives, giving gifts, being altruistic in sensuality, those three physical ones, telling the truth, making peace between others, speaking meaningfully and speaking sweetly for speech, and having a loving mind, cultivating a loving mind, cultivating a generous mind and a detached mind, and cultivating a realistic view of life, reality. And by these tenfold skillful evolutionary paths, I will shape my innermost being and even my outermost experience in a positive direction. That's the third one, and you know that now. And the fourth one is then give up unrealistic prioritization of my attention and effort and concern, and lessen my prioritization of worldly goals to achieve this, to get that, to possess the other, etc., etc., in a worldly way, knowing that those goals are of lesser value, they really ultimately are not satisfying, and only settling for nirvana, for really living within close contact of reality, and trusting Buddha that it will be blissful, and that it's possible that I can live in that way. So anyway, those are the four things which lead to transcendence, and if you meditated them a little, or can experimentally think about having meditated them a little, rehearsing it, so to speak, you can see logically, if you don't feel that, that you then feel a certain kind of relief. You realize that quality of your moments are what you're doing here, and these other concerns and worries that we have so much invested in are actually still to be considered, of course, usually, but not of really existential concern. Just sort of practical things, but not to put deep anxiety into or overly intense obsession with. And this gives us a feeling of relief. And we feel somehow, even with 100 emails waiting for us, we feel a certain leisure. And we feel we'd rather look at the flower and enjoy it, and then offer that enjoyment to all beings as we're enjoying. And little practices like that, combining with our daily existence. When something goes wrong, being tolerant and using it as a way of cultivating our freedom from bondage to stimulants. And when we feel that kind of a relief, we realize that orienting ourselves to reality, quality, and being motivated to seek such reality and quality is tremendously beneficial, and we then reflect on other beings around us, and we think of the expressions on their face, and to the degree that we have taken some compassion on ourselves and excused ourselves from really worrying about not being president of the United States, or not having this or that thing, or whatever. I mean, still maybe concerned about it, I'm working for some worthy goal, but not being so completely bent out of shape about it. And we realize that the beings around us are all bent out of shape about really mainly useless things. They think they'll get a great benefit out of winning this or getting that, and it turns out that they don't enjoy it when they get it, and then they just want 10 more, or they worry about losing what they got. And so they are completely, in a way, wasting their precious human lifetime. We see that, and we see their kind of inner dissatisfaction, anxiety and fear, feeling of stress, the less we feel stressed and anxious and frightened, the more we automatically notice how deeply others are afflicted in that way, pretty much. Occasionally we see a really calm and clear face of a truly happy person, not just the one that says, I'm fine, type of thing, insistently, but the one who, without saying it, seems to be, right away, has that vibe. There are a few like that, but mostly in real stressed out people around us. So now we're coming to the second main sector of the path, which is this compassion, love and compassion sector. And this becomes a natural thing because developing transcendent renunciation from those first four themes to whatever degree gives us this kind of relief. We're like a little bit of a dropout, a little bit of a, we have a little bit of an, the warrior's abandon, as the Yaqui Indians say. And we feel kind of different than we did. And we realize that others would benefit feeling that way. So that's the start. And now there are two different major meditative paths for cultivating compassion for all beings, for others. And one comes from the Bodhisattva Maitreya, the future Buddha, the loving Buddha, as he's called. And the other comes from Manjushri, the Bodhisattva, or the Buddha who is the critical wisdom of all Buddhas, kind of celestial Bodhisattva. And we'll do the first one, and it's called the Sevenfold Cause and Effect Training or Precept. And the first step is connected to what you have practiced in a way, let's say, not necessarily automatically come to strong commonsensical conviction, but tried on for size the idea of having had infinite previous lives, of being somehow yourself now as you are the fruition of all your evolutionary actions in many previous lives. And that awareness, of course, and the inference that comes from that, beginning to feel that is somehow plausible, which takes effort, and I don't expect necessarily everyone does. But you can also imagine how you'd feel if it did seem normal to you. Then you, by inference, you realize that other beings have also had infinite previous lives. And then you come up with the shocking realization, which Buddha did under the Bodhi tree at a visceral level. And here we're just at a conscious contemplative level. Shocking realization that given the infinity, the beginninglessness of our life and others' lives, that we've always been here struggling along, traveling, migrating from life to life. We're all migrants, actually, immigrants. Emigrants and immigrants. Actually, the Bhutanese word for a living being is a migrant, actually, doa. A being that travels. That is, that means living being, actually, in those languages, one of the synonyms. Which means that we cannot say that we have not lived, at least a lifetime, if not many, in every conceivable relationship with every other being. You know, these have been negative and positive, but without limit. But the focus here is therefore, however, every single being has in some lifetime or another, as a human being, because we have been human in many previous lives, as well as other life forms, has been our mother. The mammal-human mother-mother relationship. And without being enlightened, the mother is the most altruistic, just a biologically determined, most altruistic possible way of relating to another. the way you as a mother relate to your offspring. Now there are some who have personality problems and this and that and the other which people can point to, but nevertheless, the basic wiring of it, the natural wiring of it, is to adore that infant, child, and often mothers will give their lives for their children's lives. Even in subhuman things, lions and tigers and dogs and cats, sometimes they will. Humans especially so. So that means, sort of to the extent that we can feel our own infinite past, identify with all our own previous existences in every conceivable form, and recognize others as having, being that huge, being the expression of a huge, infinite biological experience, we have been the beneficiary of others' motherly attentions many times. And this step in the meditation is called mother recognition. And it means recognizing the motherliness in every being. And it fits with that feeling of being a beginningless being, ourselves and others. And it, which of course requires transcending some dogma or theory or legend about how it all started at some point. Or we started at the age of 4 when we recognize ourselves as egocentric individuals or whatever. Breaking through such dogmas. So that is the first step. We've all been each other's mothers. You've all been my child when I was a female and had children. And I forgive you for all the heartache you caused me. And you, I have been the child of every single one of you, including the men, when you were female, as you have been many times in previous life. And I apologize for bothering you the way children can do. But this is the, there is this underlying history we all have with all beings, actually. And when you meditate on this, sometimes quickly, sometimes in a few weeks, sometimes in a few months, you have this experience whenever you see anyone, actually, that you have a déjà vu experience. Because in a way, they no matter how weird they look, or how strange they are, or what kind of person they are, you have this sense of familiarity with them. Because you have cultivated this idea of them having been your mother. And this is also one of the secrets of the Bhutanese culture, in our, you know, to keep it in the context of our inner tour, inner pilgrimage. The Bhutanese have this idea of filtering down because of their reality view of biology, which is, means karma. Karma is not some mystical, mysterious thing, it's the biological explanation. And this is therefore part of their culture. And this is why people feel at home in a place like Bhutan, and they, or Tibet for that matter, or the refugee exiles in India or whatever, is that they have a sort of less in their deep formative layers of their attitudes toward others. When they look at you, they kind of, without even thinking it, they see you as somehow familiar. And you feel seen as if you were familiar. You don't feel like someone looks at you like an alien, like you're of a different color, a different shape, different size, you know. The Bhutanese say chilip, and the Tibetans say inji. They call all of us foreigners inji. Even Japanese they call inji, or chilip. But in a way it doesn't have a sting that some of the of more isolated beings and isolated societies who are very much into they are the only human beings and others of other races are somehow less than them and unrelated to them. And that's because this mother recognition meditation is embedded in the Bhutanese and the Tibetan and the Indian culture, ancient Indian culture. So just reflect on this. Everyone has been your mother. And then the second step is the first step. There are six steps in this meditation. And the second step is to remember your mother of this lifetime, her kindness. And that you could call it a gratitude meditation. And some of us have had personality issues as we grew up and grew older with our mothers. And, you know, it may not be easy to think of the loving kindness of the mother as the overwhelming thing radiating from our mother of this lifetime. And so it requires us working backwards in our memory. And when you meditate, you can do that very quickly. You don't need a shrink, actually. In this meditation, you can very quickly surprise yourself with what you can remember from having been an infant, if you really do meditate on it for like a more lengthy period. Because we all remember everything, actually. All those memories are there, down, up and down the dusty corridors of our neural net, and even beyond our neural net, in the cloud awareness of our soul mind. And then we can remember the smiling face of the mother looking adoringly down on the little Google Gaga. Look at that queen, the grandma, and the little boy and her mother looking on very, very reverently at the little child whose name is Avalokiteshvara. Very sweet. And we can remember, if we've been a mother in this lifetime, we can remember how we felt at the very first, when even the kaka was mother's gold. And we weren't bothered by anything, and it was just so fantastic. And even we fathers can remember a little bit of doting attitude. And everyone has gone through it, and everyone has experienced it, of course, when they were little. Before there were personality issues and clashes of adolescence and onward, or even earlier. And so if you, the signal that you have succeeded in the second step meditation is when you feel sentimental and you maybe have tears in your eyes thinking about your mother of this life. And this, in the Tibetan books they say that maybe the hackles on the back of your neck rise up, the little hairs on the back of your neck, with a kind of thrilling, in a sense of thrill, of how amazing this love was of one's mother. How she troubled herself, and how she took care of me, and how she was, you know, didn't sleep when I was sick, and how she worried, and etc. You know, besides all the other just the daily efforts. And so if you feel very sentimental about it and very moved and touched, that's a good, that's then you are doing this meditation, you're cultivating that emotion. And it is capped off with the feeling of gratitude. How kind that, and appreciation of that. And then, because this is built on this connects to the insight of the motherliness of all beings, your feeling about your mother of this life spreads a little to encompass other beings, and you realize everyone did like that for me. Every single one did. They were all so kind to me. And your kind of sentimental appreciation and deep gratitude overflows. Because in this six steps of meditation, the lower ones, it isn't that you sort of tick them off and then leave them. They stay with you as you move into the next step. So your feeling about the mother of this life and the tremendous appreciation that you feel spreads automatically toward all beings that you have recognized as your mother, as having motherly attitude in their being toward you. if you had some difficulties with your mother this life, you have to sort of re-recognize her as your mother at the deep biological level. Becomes part of the task, perhaps. And then, when these two have become part of our outlook, being, we can move to the third step, which is the step of wishing to repay that kindness. Sort of the other part of gratitude, which is the wish to repay the kindness of the one who has benefited us, who has been so kind to us. And so then we think of what can we do for these mother beings? In the Bhutanese language, in prayers and things, when they say all sentient beings, may all sentient beings be Buddhas, may all sentient beings be free of suffering, may all sentient beings be happy and have the cause of happiness, may they not suffer and have the cause of freedom from suffering, etc. This kind of prayer, they often say, may all mother sentient beings. They have put the word mother, ma, which in Tibetan is ma, or dzongka is ma. It's this ma semjen tamje, meaning all mother sentient beings. Or ma droa samje, tamje. Ma droa kun, all mother migrant beings. So it's totally embedded in the culture, this idea of the motherliness of other beings. So how can we repay our mothers? They kept us from suffering. They fed us. They cleaned us. They cherished us. They stroked us. They filled us with their love and protection. How can we do that for other beings? We develop like a strong will and a motive to repay the kindness of these mother beings. And that's the third meditative step. Built on this foundation of mother recognition and remembrance of mother kindness. And then will to repay that kindness. And then that involves our reflecting and bringing to mind all the beings, you know, the ones we know, who we like and dislike even, and the ones we don't feel strongly one way or another about, but we're beginning to like them all a little bit more because we're seeing that motherliness even in the enemy from having meditated these first three steps. And then what we do is we imagine them as being happy, because in order to have a strong will to make them happy, it's like the doctor, in order to have a good bedside manner, to emanate a good placebo effect to the patient, they have to be able to sort of imagine them getting well and not sort of doom them to the idea of always going to be sick. And so then this is called the fourth step, which is called the step of lovely love, pleasant love, which means, you know, when you love someone, they seem beautiful to you, and you see their happiness in them, and you wish them to have the happiness. And, you know, beauty in the eye of the beholder, you know, they have such expressions, general, you know, common sense psychology, that when you love them, which means you will their happiness. This is the more spiritual idea of love, not just meaning you want to possess them or something, you want to own them, you want to dominate them, but love in the sense of you just want them to be happy. True love. Wishing the will to the happiness of the beloved. And then when you really look at others through that will, they seem beautiful to you. Because beings are beautiful when they feel blissful. That is what beauty comes from, actually. When we talk of inner beauty, you know, like ugliness comes from anger and hatred and resentment, and it disfigures a person because they're feeling that inside, you know, even their complexion and their expression immediately adopts that. And one who is blissful and relaxed, you know, they automatically beautiful. So lovely love, you see your mother beings in a way having their wishes fulfilled. And you see them, their potential beauty. You envision the actual beauty they could have if their wishes were fulfilled. True wishes, deepest wishes for happiness were fulfilled. That's the fourth step of lovely love, which in a way gives one more, one's motivation, more impetus. It gives one more willpower because it seems like there's a possibility of success in repaying the kindness of these mothers by helping them free themselves from suffering and helping them find the happiness that they truly wish deep inside. And then, as these four steps, mother recognition, remembrance of kindness, wished gratefully to repay the kindness, and then lovely love, then the next step is, okay, how do I help them become happy? How do I help them find their fulfillment, these mothers of mine? And of course, one has to start with where they are. So the fifth step is the step of compassion, universal compassion for all the beings. And that step involves looking realistically at how they are. And this is a really tough one. You look around the world at all the beings, and you see the massive suffering of the beings. Huge, tremendous ordeals they go through. You know, they die, you know, their loved ones die, you know, they get sick, their loved ones get sick. They're injured or wounded or tortured, their loved ones are tortured. They starve, their loved ones starve. And they're exterminated by this and that thing. And not only human beings always, every kind of being. But even the misery among the humans is huge. It's appalling. It's overwhelming. But you're not going to be overwhelmed. Like you would not be overwhelmed by your mother of this life falling on some sort of difficulty and some sort of deep sickness, some sort of injury. You would take every effort. You wouldn't listen to anybody saying it's hopeless, whatever. You would be there for them. You would not feel right if you were not there for them. And so you, because you have built, this is built on your mother recognition, remembrance of kindness, repaying the kindness, lovely love, seeing that it is possible for everyone to find what they want. Then this compassion opens more and more to seeing the suffering of the beings and finding it unbearable, actually. And not just only feeling it, but then willing to relieve them of it somehow. And it isn't a kind of martyr thing either, because it may not be possible just to take it all. It certainly is impossible to take all that suffering on oneself, because one is not capable of experiencing such a huge suffering, actually. But the will to do so gives one the power to deal with whatever element or whatever manifestation of that suffering faces one in one's immediate circle of experience. So this builds up great intensity of compassion, this fifth step, fifth meditation. And real alertness to the real feelings of others and how they are. And then one adds to this overwhelming state of this meditation what's called overflowing resolve, or high resolve, or heroic resolve, you could say, where one resolves to say, well, you know, I can drop out, I can just shut myself off. I can have what Carl Sagan used to call compassion fatigue. And I can say, well, I just can't do anything about all of that, so I just am shut it out of my mind and not care about it. And this sixth step is where one will not do that. One will say, well, of course I can't do it all right away and by myself. And then some immediate short-term thing, such a huge thing, but I never will not care about it. And I will determine to do something about it someday or another, somehow or another. And I will be the one for my mother's being. It's like, I will be the one to take care of my mother. And I will be the one to take care of all my mothers. And this sort of, sometimes I call it messianic resolve, actually, or heroic resolve. And in a way, this is the burden of some poor person who holds elected office or who is a hereditary king in the ancient time. They did have the burden of worrying about the state of all their people, the good ones, at least. Those who are trained for it and to have that kind of noblesse oblige. And this is even beyond that. Buddha himself had been raised to be a king, and as a king he knew he had to serve his people and take their burdens upon himself. The king or queen's role is that in the traditional spiritual tradition, all spiritual traditions. But he realized that just as a political, social leader, he couldn't deal with all of the deeper sufferings of his fellow beings. He had to find something even greater power than that of a king, which is a Buddha's power. A power of giving them the tools, the mothers, the tools of understanding and positive emotion and positive action to shape their own beings to reach happiness. And so actually this is where this meditation leads one, which is, although I can't immediately go out and feed every starving being and do everything in the entire world right away, I can become the most capable possible being that there is, that could conceivably do that, that could be there for all beings for as long as it would take. And of course here, in the Buddhist culture, in the Bhutanese culture, they do have the concept that there are such beings like Avalokiteshvara, the Om Mani Padme Hum, Divine Enlightened Being, or the Shakyamuni Buddha, all many Buddhas, because there have been because of infinite past, there are already infinite beings who have become Buddhas. So there's no shortage of Buddhas. But on the other hand, they don't seem to be fixing up my mothers, at least as I see it. So I'm going to join their number. I'm going to become that. Or if I'm in a culture that doesn't have that idea of such a perfected being, such an ultimate sort of evolutionary summit of existence, I'm going to just become more and more capable, more and more able to help them. To whatever extent in a future life, I will expand that ability. And since luckily, I will have to go on anyway in future lives. And in those future lives, I want to have a greater ability to help my mothers more, the ones I can't get to in this life. And I won't have time to get to in this life. I will get them in the future, get to them in the future. And therefore, the key thing here is the attitude of universal compassion to beings and not shutting oneself off by saying, oh, it's hopeless, I can't do anything, and living the life of despair, of quiet desperation that Mr. Thoreau talked about. It's a matter of staying open on the six steps. So these are the six steps of this particular way of meditating on compassion. And creating this open attitude. And then there is a very ironic thing, and we can add this in the end of this morning's meditation, and which is what the Dalai Lama tells us when people ask him, Your Holiness, how do you stay cheerful in this terrible genocide that's going on among your people and having lost your own country and your own family and everything and your own, you know, house or your monastery or et cetera, et cetera, and feeling so deeply as you do the burden of the state of existence of your people, how do you stay so cheerful? And he says, the secret, when I get overwhelmed by the horror and enormity of it, of the suffering of my people and all people, he said, the key to getting out of the slough of despair that I will fall into is compassion. It is only compassion. And at first that's very puzzling if you think about it, and do meditate about it. Because if you think compassion means opening to the suffering of others, and cultivating the will to freedom from the suffering, and yet seeing their suffering as so huge and overwhelming, why would compassion make you feel freedom free from despair? And even sometimes he will say, if you want to be happy, be compassionate. And or sometimes he says, even if you want to be selfish, successfully in the sense of be happy yourself, be compassionate, he says. And that's not a recommendation of Schadenfreude, you know, of like relief that you're not suffering the way others are suffering. But it's more subtle than that. It's that opening to this vast suffering and somehow at least doing something at the smallest edge and baby step way about any part of it for any other being around you, you feel better. Because compassion is the action, is the energy of acting in relation to that. Empathy, you know, it isn't just empathy. It's empathetic, but then it's the will to do something about it. And this will, in order to manifest, grows from a kind of ecstatic, loving feeling, like you feel about your old mother. Your mother's dying, she has cancer, chemotherapy, she's like this or that. Let's say, some of us may have had that experience already, some may not yet, some, there may have been some other way. It seems very overwhelming and, you know, can't do anything about it sort of thing, and yet you do something about the immediate condition, the immediate feeling, you reach out in your mind, and actually, of course, in the Bhutanese culture, even you help someone through death process. You help send them to the angels, you help send them to the bardo, to the between state, you help send them to a better life in the future, not to feel too much fear in the death process, to be helped by angels and so forth, you do, or to become an angel yourself to help. You never give up that, in other words. And so this is key in our life attitude to beings and their suffering. This is where this meditation leads us. And it is the secret of our own happiness, actually. Strangely. And here we might connect it to the second precept, which is called the exchange of self and other. You know, this is the sixfold cause and the seventh fruition, which is the will to the happiness of all beings by becoming a Buddha sooner or later in a future life. But if one doesn't have an imagination of a Buddha, it's hard to do that. So here we just add to the six steps that we went through. The other one, which is called the exchange of self and other, where you just reflect about the other beings around you, and you look at your own mind and you see how you feel every day, and you get up in the morning of the day and you think, well, what can I do to be happy today? And is this, what's in it? What's in this activity for me, and what's in that, and what should I do? And you realize that you're sort of have an inner thought stream that looks out for your own well-being in a particular day. And that thought stream also operates on the presumption that you should deserve to be happy in this particular day. You should get these things that you need to be happy with. And you have a right to that happiness, and it is like that. And you have that sort of self-preoccupation, it is called, self-concern. And then you look at the beings around you, and you see, you don't have to get into their motherliness necessarily, you just see that they are also thinking that way. They think they should have whatever it is they want. And there's so many of them wanting whatever they want. And then, so this is kind of a way of you and them wanting different things, and each one isolated in their own little cycle of self-preoccupation. And then, of course, you recognize that in being that way, you never do quite get enough of what you want. You might temporarily do, but the only times you feel really contented and satisfied are when you forget to think about what else you could have. The minute you have something and then compare it with how it was before, or how it could have been, then it's never quite good enough, right? It cuts off the release of feeling contented. So then, the exchange of self for other means, okay, we're all here in this planet and we're all seeking satisfaction, but the hugeness of the other being's will to satisfaction is so much bigger than mine. If I plug into being concerned with that, I'm plugging into a bigger energy. And maybe that'll lift me into some more energetic activity towards satisfaction in general, not necessarily only mine. And then the odd thing is, I immediately feel better because why? I forget to worry about how much I have for that short time that I'm concerned about what the other one has. So this is the holy secret, it is called by the great Shantideva, by Dalai Lama, by Buddha. It's the holy secret of the exchange of self and other, that self-satisfaction comes from fulfilling others' satisfaction, from helping others find satisfaction. And that is truly the true source of self-satisfaction, actually. And it doesn't matter if there's an element, therefore, once one learns that secret, if there's an element of enlightened self-interest in it, it doesn't matter. But the key is the altruistic interest or the other motivation, which brings the fulfillment of the self-interest and the other interest. And even Dalai Lama likes to make a joke, and he says, the compassionate person, when you get into compassion and you feel love and compassion, because you want the other to be happy, you don't want the other to suffer, the first one who suffers less and gets more happy is yourself. It may not help the other one automatically, necessarily. You might do the wrong thing. You might be clumsy in helping them find that satisfaction. You might not know quite what they want, etc. And you might give them the wrong thing, whatever, you know. But just by focusing on what they want, you feel better immediately. You forget what's wrong with your situation. So that's the exchange of self and other. And of course, all of these meditations of compassion that you now are keyed into do lead one to wish to be something greater than one is. To be able to do that. Because one recognizes one's inability to be able to help others that much often. You know, when we come up against those limitations. And of course, in the Bhutanese culture, then that becomes the will to Buddhahood, you know. The will to enlightenment. The will to greater knowledge of others' true situation. Greater knowledge of reality. Which then leads to greater love for all beings, which leads to a greater way of being oneself. So meditate on that. Living your life, finding in yourself, which everyone has, this joy, this kernel of joy in the joy of others, which is what makes parents so pleased to be able to do something for their child, which makes, you know, holidays like Hanukkah, Christmas, the Ganden Gamcha in the Tibetan culture, you know, the different celebrations, Sakadawa, you know, that they have, where they give gifts to each other, you know, and they enjoy the other getting the gifts and something like that. These are all bringing out this thing. It doesn't take some sort of Buddhist teaching. Everybody has this idea. And it's very important. The meditation And we're rehearsing a meditation you could spend a long time doing, and you have been, probably many of you, and you will in your own way. In other spiritual traditions, all go in this direction, actually, all of them. Any ones that have lasted, anyway. And it leaves us in this sort of, it's basically a goodwill kind of meditation. And of course, then, and just to preview where we go next in the next session, one comes to realize through this great compassion cultivation, love and compassion cultivation, and one comes to, and the will to enlightenment, and one comes to realize through the transcendent renunciation cultivation that we learned in the previous main session, that one has to understand how the causality works. So wisdom becomes the absolute concern. What is the real nature of reality? Are these just unrealistic fantasies that I can be free of these sort of mundane concerns and false priorities? Is it just a fantasy that I can, that anything can be done about the tremendous suffering in the world? Is that just unrealistic? Or is it realistic? And there the wisdom thing becomes paramount, and that's what we will address later. Okay. Ding!
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about the music of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Study Buddhism Up Close and Personal with Robert Thurman during upcoming Tibet House U.S. trips with Geographic Expeditions. Trips in 2018 include Mongolia and Bhutan. To learn about these Tibet House member trips and the benefits of becoming a monthly supporter, please visit tibethouse.us. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dalek.